Ladies and gentlemen, please join us for Radio Lillooet's special presentation of the personal recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain.
This is Chapter 28 of Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain. Volume 2, Book 2, Chapter 28, Joan Foretells Her Doom. The troops must have a rest. 2 days would be allowed for this. The morning of the 14th I was writing from Joan's dictation in a small room which she sometimes used as a private office when she wanted to get away from officials and their interruptions. Catherine Boucher came in and sat down and said, "Joan, dear, I want you to talk to me." "Indeed, I am not sorry for that, but glad. What is in your mind?" "This. I scarcely slept last night for thinking of the dangers you are running. The paladin told me how you made the Duke stand out of the way when the cannon-balls were flying all about, and so saved his life. Well, that was right, wasn't it?"
"Right, yes, but you stayed there yourself. Why will you do like that? It seems such a wanton risk."
"Oh, no, it was not so. I was not in any danger."
"How can you say that, Joan, with those deadly things flying all about you?"
Joan laughed and tried to turn the subject, but Catherine persisted. She said,
"It was horribly dangerous, and it could not be necessary to stay in such a place. And you led an assault again. Joan, it is tempting Providence. I want you to make me a promise. I want you to promise me that you will let others lead the assaults, if there must be assaults, and that you will take better care of yourself in those dreadful battles. Will you?"
But Joan fought away from the promise and did not give it. Catherine sat troubled and discontented a while, then she said,
"Joan, are you going to be a soldier always? These wars are so long, they last forever and ever and ever."
There was a glad flash in Joan's eye as she cried,
"This campaign will do all the really hard work that is in front of it in the next 4 days. The rest of it will be gentler, oh, far less bloody. Yes, in 4 days France will gather another trophy like the redemption of Orleans, and make her second long step toward freedom."
Catherine started, and so did I. Then she gazed long at Joan like one in a trance, murmuring,
"4 days. 4 days,"
as if to herself and unconsciously. Finally she asked, in a low voice that had something of awe in it,
"Joan, tell me, how is it that you know that? For you do know it, I think."
"Yes," said Joan dreamily, "I know, I know. I shall strike, and strike again, and before the 4th day is finished I shall strike yet again."
She became silent. We sat wondering and still. This was for a whole minute, she looking at the floor and her lips moving but uttering nothing. Then came these words, but hardly audible,
"And in 1,000 years the English power in France will not rise up from that blow."
It made my flesh creep. It was uncanny. She was in a trance again. I could see it. Just as she was that day in the pastures of Domremy when she prophesied about us boys and the war, and afterward did not know that she had done it. She was not conscious now, but Catherine did not know that, and so she said in a happy voice,
"Oh, I believe it, I believe it, and I am so glad. Then you will come back and bide with us all your life long, and we will love you so, and honor you."
A scarcely perceptible spasm flitted across Joan's face, and the dreamy voice muttered,
"Before 2 years are sped, I shall die a cruel death."
I sprang forward with a warning hand up. That is why Catherine did not scream. She was going to do that. I saw it plainly. Then I whispered her to slip out of the place and say nothing of what had happened. I said Joan was asleep, asleep and dreaming. Catherine whispered back and said,
"Oh, I am so grateful that it is only a dream. It sounded like prophecy."
And she was gone. Like prophecy. I knew it was prophecy. And I sat down crying, as knowing we should lose her. Soon she started, shivering slightly, and came to herself, and looked around and saw me crying there,
and jumped out of her chair and ran to me all in a whirl of sympathy and compassion, and put her hand on my head and said, "My poor boy, what is it? Look up and tell me." I had to tell her a lie. I grieved to do it, but there was no other way. I picked up an old letter from my table, written by heaven knows who, about some matter heaven knows what, and told her I had just gotten it from Père Fronte, and that in it said the children's fairy tree had been chopped down by some miscreant or other, and I got no further. She snatched the letter from my hand and searched it up and down and all over, turning it this way and that, and sobbing great sobs, and the tears flowing down her cheeks, and ejaculating all the time, "Oh, cruel, cruel, how could any be so heartless? Ah, poor arbre fait de Bourlemont, gone, and we children loved it so. Show me the place where it says it." And I, still lying, showed her the pretended fatal words on the pretended fatal page, and she gazed at them through her tears, and said she could see herself that they were hateful, ugly words. They had the very look of it. Then we heard a strong voice down the corridor announcing,
"His Majesty's messenger, with dispatches for Her Excellency, the Commander-in-Chief of the Armies of France."
End of chapter 28. Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain. Volume 2, Book 2, Chapter 29. Fierce Talbot Reconsiders. I knew she had seen the vision of the tree, but when? I could not know. Doubtless before she had lately told the king to use her, for that she had but 1 year left to work in. It had not occurred to me at the time, but the conviction came upon me now that at that time she had already seen the tree. It had brought her a welcome message, that was plain. Otherwise she could not have been so joyous and light-hearted as she had been these latter days. The death-warning had nothing dismal about it for her. No, it was remission of exile, it was leave to come home. Yes, she had seen the tree. No one had taken the prophecy to heart which she made to the king, and for a good reason, no doubt. No one wanted to take it to heart. All wanted to banish it away and forget it, and all had succeeded, and would go on to the end placid and comfortable. All but me alone. I must carry my awful secret without any to help me. A heavy load, a bitter burden, and would cost me a daily heartbreak. She was to die, and so soon. I had never dreamed of that. How could I? And she so strong and fresh and young, and every day earning a new right to a peaceful and honored old age. For at that time I thought old age was valuable. I do not know why, but I thought so. All young people think it, I believe, they being ignorant and full of superstitions. She had seen the tree. All that miserable night those ancient verses went floating back and forth through my brain. And when, in exile wandering, we shall fainting yearn for glimpse of thee, oh, rise upon our sight! But at dawn the bugles and the drums burst through the dreamy hush of the morning, and it was turn out all, mount and ride, for there was red work to be done. We marched to Meung without halting. There we carried the bridge by assault, and left a force to hold it. The rest of the army marching away next morning towards Beaugency, where the lion Talbot, the terror of the French, was in command. When we arrived at that place, the English retired into the castle, and we sat down in the abandoned town. Talbot was not at the moment present in person, for he had gone away to watch for and welcome Fastolf and his reinforcement of 5,000 men. Joan placed her batteries and bombarded the castle till night. Then some news came. Richemont, Constable of France, this long time in disgrace with the king, largely because of the evil machinations of La Tremouille and his party, was approaching with a large body of men to offer his services to Joan, and very much she needed them, now that Fastolf was so close by. Richemont had wanted to join us before, when we first marched on Orléans, but the foolish king, slave of those paltry advisers of his, warned him to keep his distance, and refused all reconciliation with him. I go into these details because they are important. Important because they lead up to the exhibition of a new gift in Joan's extraordinary mental makeup, statesmanship. It is a sufficiently strange thing to find that great quality in an ignorant country girl of 17 and a half, but she had it. Joan was for receiving Richemont cordially, and so was La Hire and the two young Laval and other chiefs, but the lieutenant-general d'Alençon strenuously and stubbornly opposed it. He said he had absolute orders from the king to deny and defy Richemont, and that if they were overridden he would leave the army. This would have been a heavy disaster indeed, but Joan set herself the task of persuading him that the salvation of France took precedence of all minor things, even the commands of a sceptered ass, and she accomplished it. She persuaded him to disobey the king in the interest of the nation, and to be reconciled to Count Richemont and welcome him. That was statesmanship, and of the highest and soundest sort. Whatever thing men call great, look for it in Joan of Arc, and there you will find it. In the early morning, June 17th, the scouts reported the approach of Talbot and Fastolf with Fastolf's succoring force. Then the drums beat to arms, and we set forth to meet the English, leaving Richemont and his troops behind to watch the castle of Beaugency and keep its garrison at home. By and by we came in sight of the enemy. Fastolf had tried to convince Talbot that it would be wisest to retreat and not risk a battle with Joan at this time, but distribute the new levies among the English strongholds of the Loire, thus securing them against capture. Then be patient and wait for more levies from Paris. Let Joan exhaust her army with fruitless daily skirmishing, then at the right time fall upon her in resistless mass and annihilate her. He was a wise old experienced general, was Fastolf, but that fierce Talbot would hear of no delay. He was in a rage over the punishment which the Maid had inflicted upon him at Orléans and since, and he swore by God and St. George that he would have it out with her if he had to fight her all alone. So Fastolf yielded, though he said they were now risking the loss of everything which the English had gained by so many years' work and so many hard knocks. The enemy had taken up a strong position and were waiting, in order of battle, with their archers to the front and a stockade before them. Night was coming on. A messenger came from the English with a rude defiance and an offer of battle, but Joan's dignity was not ruffled, her bearing was not discomposed. She said to the herald, "Go back and say it is too late to meet tonight, but tomorrow, please God and Our Lady, we will come to close quarters." The night fell dark and rainy. It was that sort of light, steady rain which falls so softly and brings to one's spirit such serenity and peace. About 10 o'clock, d'Alençon, the bastard of Orléans, La Hire, Poton of Cetray, and two or three other generals came to our headquarters tent and sat down to discuss matters with Joan. Some thought it was a pity that Joan had declined battle, some thought not. Then Poton asked her why she had declined it. She said, "There was more than one reason. These English are ours. They cannot get away from us. Wherefore there is no need to take risks, as at other times. The day was far spent. It is good to have much time and the fair light of day, when one's force is in a weakened state. 900 of us yonder keeping the bridge of Meung under the Marshal de Ré, 1500 with the Constable of France keeping the bridge and watching the castle of Beaugency." Dunois said, "I grieve for this decision, Excellency, but it cannot be helped, and the case will be the same the morrow as to that." Joan was walking up and down just then. She laughed her affectionate, comrade-y laugh, and stopping before that old war-tiger, she put her small hand above his head and touched one of his plumes, saying, "Now tell me, wise man, which feather is it that I touch?"
"In sooth, Excellency, that I cannot."
"Name of God, bastard, bastard! You cannot tell me this small thing, yet are bold to name a large one, telling us what is in the stomach of the unborn morrow, that we shall not have those men. Now it is my thought that they will be with us." That made a stir. All wanted to know why she thought that, but La Hire took the word and said,
"Let be. If she thinks it, that is enough. It will happen."
Then Poton of Cetray said,
"There were other reasons for declining battle, according to the saying of your Excellency?"
"Yes. One was that, we being weak and the day far gone, the battle might not be decisive. When it is fought it must be decisive, and it shall be."
"God grant it,"
and amen. There were still other reasons?
One other, yes. She hesitated a moment, then said, This was not the day. Tomorrow is the day. It is so written.
They were going to assail her with eager questionings, but she put up her hand and prevented them. And then she said,
It will be the most noble and beneficent victory that God has vouchsafed for France at any time. I pray you question me not as to whence or how I know this thing, but be content that it is so.
There was pleasure in every face, and conviction and high confidence. A murmur of conversation broke out, but that was interrupted by a messenger from the outposts who brought news, namely, that for an hour there had been stir and movement in the English camp of a sort unusual at such a time, and with a resting army, he said. Spies had been sent under cover of the rain and darkness to inquire into it. They had just come back and reported that large bodies of men had been dimly made out, who were slipping stealthily away in the direction of Meung. The generals were very much surprised, as any might tell from their faces.
"'It is a retreat,' said Joan.
"'It has that look,' said d'Alençon.
"'It certainly has,'
observed the bastard and La Hire.
"'It was not to be expected,' said Louis de Bourbon, "'but one can divine the purpose of it.'
"'Yes,' responded Joan. "'Talbot has reflected. His rash brain has cooled. He thinks to take the bridge of Meung and escape to the other side of the river.' He knows that this leaves his garrison of Beaugency at the mercy of fortune to escape our hands if it can, but there is no other course if he would avoid this battle, and that he also knows. But he shall not get the bridge. We will see to that.
Yes, said d'Alençon, we must follow him and take care of that matter. What of Beaugency?
Leave Beaugency to me, gentle Duke. I will have it in 2 hours, and at no cost of blood.
It is true, Excellency. You will but need to deliver this news there and receive the surrender.
Yes, and I will be with you at Meung with the dawn, fetching the constable and his 1,500. And when Talbot knows that Beaugency has fallen, it will have an effect upon him.
By the mass, yes, cried La Hire. He will join his Meung garrison to his army and break for Paris. Then we shall have our bridge force with us again, along with our Beaugency watchers, and be stronger for our great day's work by 420 able soldiers, as was here promised within the hour. Verily, this Englishman is doing our errands for us and saving us much blood and trouble. Orders, Excellency, give us orders.
They are simple. Let the men rest 3 hours longer. At 1 o'clock the advance guard will march under our command, with Poton of Saint-Tré as second. The second division will follow at 2 under the lieutenant-general. Keep well in the rear of the enemy, and see to it that you avoid an engagement. I will ride under guard to Beaugency, and make so quick work there that I and the constable of France will join you before dawn with his men.
She kept her word. Her guard mounted, and we rode off through the puttering rain, taking with us a captured English officer to confirm Joan's news. We soon covered the journey, and summoned the castle. Richard Guertin, Talbot's lieutenant, being convinced that he and his 500 men were left helpless, conceded that it would be useless to try to hold out. He could not expect easy terms, yet Joan granted them nevertheless. His garrison could keep their horses and arms, and carry away property to the value of a silver mark per man. They could go whither they pleased, but must not take arms against France again under 10 days. Before dawn we were with our army again, and with us the constable and nearly all his men, for we left only a small garrison in Beaugency Castle. We heard the dull booming of cannon to the front, and knew that Talbot was beginning his attack on the bridge. But some time before it was yet light, the sound ceased, and we heard it no more. Guertin had sent a messenger through our lines, under a safe conduct, given by Joan, to tell Talbot of the surrender. Of course this poursuivant had arrived ahead of us. Talbot had held it wisdom to turn now and retreat upon Paris. When daylight came, he had disappeared, and with him Lord Scales and the garrison of Meung. What a harvest of English strongholds we had reaped in those 3 days, strongholds which had defied France with quite cool confidence and plenty of it until we came. End of chapter 29. Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain, Volume 2, Book 2, Chapter 30, The Red Field of Patay. When the morning broke at last on that forever memorable 18th of June,
There was no enemy discoverable anywhere, as I have said. But that did not trouble me. I knew we should find him, and that we should strike him the promised blow, the one from which the English power in France would not rise up in 1,000 years, as Joan had said in her trance. The enemy had plunged into the wide plains of La Beauce, a roadless waste covered with bushes, with here and there bodies of forest trees, a region where an army would be hidden from view in a very little while. We found the trail in the soft, wet earth and followed it. It indicated an orderly march, no confusion, no panic. But we had to be cautious. In such a piece of country we could walk into an ambush without any trouble. Therefore Joan sent bodies of cavalry ahead under La Hire, Poton, and other captains, to feel the way. Some of the other officers began to show uneasiness. This sort of hide-and-go-seek business troubled them and made their confidence a little shaky. Joan divined their state of mind and cried out impetuously, "Name of God, what would you? We must smite these English, and we will. They shall not escape us. Though they were hung to the clouds, we would get them." By and by we were nearing Pathé. It was about a league away. Now at this time our reconnaissance, feeling its way in the bush, frightened a deer, and it went bounding away and was out of sight in a moment. Then hardly a minute later a dull great shout went up in the distance toward Pathé. It was the English soldiery. They had been shut up in a garrison so long on moldy food that they could not keep their delight to themselves when this fine fresh meat came springing into their midst. Poor creature, it had wrought damage to a nation which loved it well, for the French knew where the English were now, whereas the English had no suspicion of where the French were. La Hire halted where he was, and sent back the tidings. Joan was radiant with joy. The Duc d'Alençon said to her, "Very well, we have found them. Shall we fight them?"
"Have you good spurs, Prince?"
"Why? Will they make us run away?"
"Nenny, oh, nom de Dieu, these English are ours. They are lost. They will fly. Who overtakes them will need good spurs. Forward, close up."
By the time we had come up with La Hire, the English had discovered our presence. Talbot's force was marching in three bodies, first his advance guard, then his artillery, then his battle corps a good way in the rear. He was now out of the bush and in a fair open country. He had at once posted his artillery, his advance guard, and 500 picked archers along some hedges where the French would be obliged to pass, and hoped to hold this position till his battle corps could come up. Sir John Fastolf urged the battle corps into a gallop. Joan saw her opportunity and ordered La Hire to advance, which La Hire promptly did, launching his wild riders like a stormy wind, his customary fashion. The Duke and the Bastard wanted to follow, but Joan said, "Not yet. Wait." So they waited, impatiently, and fidgeting in their saddles. But she was ready, gazing straight before her, measuring, weighing, calculating, by shades, minutes, fractions of minutes, seconds, with all her great soul present in eye and set of head and noble pose of body, but patient, steady, master of herself and of the situation. And yonder, receding, receding, plumes lifting and falling, streamed the thundering charge of La Hire's godless crew, La Hire's great figure dominating it, and his sword stretched aloft like a flagstaff.
"Oh, Satan and his hellions, see them go!"
somebody muttered in a deep admiration. And now he was closing up on Fastolf's rushing corps. And now he struck it hard and broke its order. It lifted the Duke and the Bastard in their saddles to see it, and they turned, trembling with excitement, to Joan, saying, "Now!" But she put up her hand, still gazing, weighing, calculating, and said again, "Wait, not yet." Fastolf's hard-driven battle corps raged on like an avalanche toward the waiting advance guard. Suddenly these conceived the idea that it was flying in panic before Joan, and so in that instant it broke and swarmed away in a mad panic itself, with Talbot storming and cursing after it. Now was the golden time. Joan drove her spurs home and waved the advance with her sword. "Follow me!" she cried, and bent her head to her horse's neck and sped away like the wind. We went down into the confusion of that flying rout, and for 3 long hours we cut and hacked and stabbed. At last the bugles sang, "Halt!" The battle of Pathé was won.
Joan of Arc dismounted and stood surveying that awful field, lost in thought. Presently she said,
"The praise is to God. He has smitten with a heavy hand this day."
After a little she lifted her face and looked afar off, said, with the manner of one who is thinking aloud,
"In a thousand years, the English power in France will not rise up from this blow."
She stood again a time thinking. Then she turned toward her grouped generals, and there was a glory in her face and a noble light in her eye, and she said,
"Oh, friends, do you know? Do you comprehend? France is on the way to be free."
"And had never been but for Joan of Arc," said La Hire, passing before her and bowing low, the others following and doing likewise, he muttering as he went, "I will say it, though I be damned for it."
Then battalion after battalion of our victorious army swung by, wildly cheering, and they shouted,
"Live forever, Maid of Orleans! Live forever!"
while Joan, smiling, stood at the salute with her sword. This was not the last time I saw the Maid of Orleans on the red field of Patay. Toward the end of the day I came upon her where the dead and dying lay stretched all about in heaps and windrows. Our men had mortally wounded an English prisoner who was too poor to pay a ransom, and from a distance she had seen that cruel thing done, and had galloped to the place and sent for a priest, and now she was holding the head of her dying enemy in her lap, and easing him to his death with comforting soft words, just as his sister might have done, and the womanly tears running down her face all the time. Footnote 1. Lord Ronald Gower, Joan of Arc, page 82, says, Michelet discovered this story in the deposition of Joan of Arc's page, Louis de Comte, who was probably an eyewitness of the scene. This is true. It was a part of the testimony of the author of these Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc, given by him in the rehabilitation proceedings of 1456. Translator. End of note 1. End of chapter 30. Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain. Volume 2, Book 2, Chapter 31. France Begins to Live Again. Joan had said true. France was on the way to be free. The war, called the Hundred Years' War, was very sick today. Sick on its English side, for the very first time since its birth, 91 years gone by. Shall we judge battles by the numbers killed and the ruin wrought? Or shall we not rather judge them by the results which flowed from them? Anyone will say that a battle is only truly great or small according to its results. Yes, anyone will grant that, for it is the truth. Judged by results, Patay's place is with the few supremely great and imposing battles that have been fought since the peoples of the world first resorted to arms for the settlement of their quarrels. So judged, it is even possible that Patay has no peer among that few just mentioned, but stands alone as the supremest of historic conflicts. For when it began, France lay gasping out the remnant of an exhausted life, her case wholly hopeless in the view of all political physicians. When it ended, 3 hours later, she was convalescent. Convalescent and nothing requisite but time and ordinary nursing to bring her back to perfect health. The dullest physician of them all could see this, and there was none to deny it. Many death-sick nations have reached convalescence through a series of battles, a procession of battles, a weary tale of wasting conflicts stretching over years, but only one has reached it in a single day and by a single battle. That nation is France, and that battle, Patay. Remember it and be proud of it, for you are French, and it is the stateliest fact in the long annals of your country. There it stands, with its head in the clouds. And when you grow up, you will go on pilgrimage to the field of Patay, and stand uncovered in the presence of, what, a monument with its head in the clouds? Yes, for all nations in all times have built monuments on their battlefields to keep green the memory of the perishable deed that was wrought there, and of the perishable name of him who wrought it. And will France neglect Patay and Joan of Arc? Not for long. And will she build a monument scaled to their rank as compared with the world's other fields and heroes? Perhaps, if there be room for it under the arch of the sky. But let us look back a little, and consider certain strange and impressive facts. The Hundred Years' War began in 1337. It raged on and on, year after year and year after year, and at last England stretched France prone with that fearful blow at Crecy. But she rose and struggled on year after year, and at last again she went down under another devastating blow, Poitiers. She gathered her crippled strength once more, and the war raged on, and still on, year after year, decade after decade. Children were born, grew up, married, died. The war raged on. Their children in turn grew up, married, died. The war raged on. Their children, growing, saw France struck down again, this time under the incredible disaster of Agincourt. And still the war raged on, year after year, and in time these children married in their turn. France was a wreck, a ruin, a desolation. The half of it belonged to England, with none to dispute or deny the truth. The other half belonged to nobody. In 3 months would be flying the English flag. The French king was making ready to throw away his crown and flee beyond the seas. Now came the ignorant country maid out of her remote village and confronted this hoary war, this all-consuming conflagration that had swept the land for 3 generations. Then began the briefest and most amazing campaign that is recorded in history. In 7 weeks it was finished. In 7 weeks she hopelessly crippled that gigantic war that was 91 years old. At Orléans she struck it a staggering blow. On the field of Patay she broke its back. Think of it. Yes, one can do that, but understand it? Ah, that is another matter. None will ever be able to comprehend that stupefying marvel. 7 weeks, with here and there a little bloodshed, perhaps the most of it in any single fight at Patay, where the English began 6,000 strong and left 2,000 dead upon the field. It is said and believed that in 3 battles alone, Crecy, Poitiers, and Agincourt, near 100,000 Frenchmen fell, without counting the 1,000 other fights of that long war. The dead of that war make a mournful long list, an interminable list. Of men slain in the field, the count goes by 10,000s. Of innocent women and children slain by bitter hardship and hunger, it goes by that appalling term, millions. It was an ogre, that war, an ogre that went about for near 100 years, crunching men and dripping blood from its jaws, and with her little hand that child of 17 struck him down, and yonder he lies stretched on the field of Patay, and will not get up any more while this old world lasts. End of chapter 31.
From our high mountain transmitters to your FM dial, this is Radio Lillooet, 100.5 FM.
A kiss with a casket, a brown and yellow basket. I send a letter to my mommy on the way I die.
Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain. Volume 2, Book 2, Chapter 32, The Joyous News Flies Fast. The great news of Patay was carried over the whole of France in 20 hours, people said. I do not know as to that, but one thing is sure, anyway. The moment a man got it, he flew shouting and glorifying God and told his neighbor, and that neighbor flew with it to the next homestead, and so on, without resting, the word traveled. And when a man got it in the night, at what hour soever, he jumped out of his bed and bore the blessed message along, and the joy that went with it was like the light that flows across the land when an eclipse is receding from the face of the sun. And, indeed, you may say that France had lain in an eclipse this long time, yes, buried in a black gloom which these beneficent tidings were sweeping away now before the onrush of their white splendor. The news beat the flying enemy to Yeovil, and the town rose against its English masters and shut the gates against their brethren. It flew to Montpipeau, to Saint-Simon, and to this, that, and the other English fortress, and straightway the garrison applied the torch and took to the fields and the woods. A detachment of our army occupied Meung and pillaged it. When we reached Orléans, that town was as much as 50 times insaner with joy than we had ever seen it before, which is saying much. Night had just fallen, and the illuminations were on so wonderful a scale that we seemed to plough through seas of fire, and as to the noise, the hoarse cheering of the multitude, the thundering of cannon, the clash of bells, indeed, there was never anything like it. And everywhere rose a new cry that burst upon us like a storm when the column entered the gates, and never more ceased.
"Welcome to Joan of Arc! Way for the Savior of France!"
And there was another cry.
"Crecy is avenged! Poitiers is avenged! Agincourt is avenged! Pate shall live forever!"
Mad? Why, you never could imagine it in the world. The prisoners were in the center of the column. When that came along, and the people caught sight of their masterful old enemy Talbot, that had made them dance so long to his grim war music, you may imagine what the uproar was like if you can, for I cannot describe it. They were so glad to see him that presently they wanted to have him out and hang him. So Joan had him brought up to the front to ride in her protection. They made a striking pair. End of chapter 32. Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain. Volume 2, Book 2, Chapter 33, Joan's Five Great Deeds. Yes, Orléans was in a delirium of felicity. She invited the king and made sumptuous preparations to receive him, but he didn't come. He was simply a serf at that time, and La Tremouille was his master. Master and serf were visiting together at the master's castle of Sully-sur-Loire. At Beaugency, Joan had engaged to bring about a reconciliation between the constable Richemont and the king. She took Richemont to Sully-sur-Loire and made her promise good. The great deeds of Joan of Arc are five. 1. The raising of the siege. 2. The victory of Pate. 3. The reconciliation at Sully-sur-Loire. 4. The coronation of the king. 5. The bloodless march. We shall come to the bloodless march presently, and the coronation. It was the victorious long march which Joan made through the enemy's country from Gien to Rheims, and thence to the gates of Paris, capturing every English town and fortress that barred the road from the beginning of the journey to the end of it, and this by the mere force of her name, and without shedding a drop of blood, perhaps the most extraordinary campaign in this regard in history. This is the most glorious of her military exploits. The reconciliation was one of Joan's most important achievements. No one else could have accomplished it, and, in fact, no one else of high consequence had any disposition to try. In brains, in scientific warfare, and in statesmanship, the Constable Richemont was the ablest man in France. His loyalty was sincere. His probity was above suspicion, and it made him sufficiently conspicuous in that trivial and conscienceless court. In restoring Richemont to France, Joan made thoroughly secure the successful completion of the great work which she had begun. She had never seen Richemont until he came to her with his little army. Was it not wonderful that at a glance she should know him for the one man who could finish and perfect her work and establish it in perpetuity? How was it that that child was able to do this? It was because she had the seeing eye, as one of her knights had once said. Yes, she had that great gift, almost the highest and rarest that has been granted to man. Nothing of an extraordinary sort was still to be done, yet the remaining work could not safely be left to the king's idiots, for it would require wise statesmanship and long and patient, though desultory, hammering of the enemy. Now and then, for a quarter of a century yet, there would be a little fighting to do, and a handy man could carry that on with small disturbance to the rest of the country. And little by little, and with progressive certainty, the English would disappear from France. And that happened. Under the influence of Richemont, the king became at a later time a man, a king, a brave and capable and determined soldier. Within 6 years after Pathé, he was leading storming parties himself, fighting in fortress ditches up to his waist in water, and climbing scaling ladders under a furious fire with a pluck that would have satisfied even Joan of Arc. In time he and Richemont cleared away all the English, even from regions where the people had been under their mastership for 300 years. In such regions wise and careful work was necessary, for the English rule had been fair and kindly, and men who have been ruled in that way are not always anxious for a change. Which of Joan's 5 chief deeds shall we call the chiefest? It is my thought that each in its turn was that. This is saying that, taken as a whole, they equalized each other, and neither was then greater than its mate. Do you perceive? Each was a stage in an ascent. To leave out one of them would defeat the journey. To achieve one of them at the wrong time and in the wrong place would have the same effect. Consider the coronation. As a masterpiece of diplomacy, where can you find its superior in our history? Did the king suspect its vast importance? No. Did his ministers? No. Did the astute Bedford, representative of the English crown? No. An advantage of incalculable importance was here under the eyes of the king and of Bedford. The king could get it by a bold stroke. Bedford could get it without an effort. But, being ignorant of its value, neither of them put forth his hand. Of all the wise people in high office in France, only one knew the priceless worth of this neglected prize, the untaught child of 17, Joan of Arc. And she had known it from the beginning as an essential detail of her mission. How did she know it? It was simple. She was a peasant. That tells the whole story. She was of the people and knew the people. Those others moved in a loftier sphere and knew nothing much about them. We make little account of that vague, formless, inert mass, that mighty underlying force which we call the people, an epithet which carries contempt with it. It is a strange attitude, for at bottom we know that the throne which the people support stands, and that when that support is removed, nothing in this world can save it. Now then, consider this fact, and observe its importance. Whatever the parish priest believes, his flock believes. They love him, they revere him. He is their unfailing friend, their dauntless protector, their comforter in sorrow, their helper in their day of need. He has their whole confidence, and what he tells them to do, that they will do, with a blind and affectionate obedience, let it cost what it may. Add these facts thoughtfully together, and what is the sum? This: the parish priest governs the nation. What is the king, then, if the parish priest withdraws his support and deny his authority? Merely a shadow and no king. Let him resign. Do you get that idea? Then let us proceed. A priest is consecrated to his office by the awful hand of God, laid upon him by his appointed representative on earth. That consecration is final. Nothing can undo it. Nothing can remove it. Neither the Pope nor any other power can strip the priest of his office. God gave it, and it is forever sacred and secure. The dull parish knows all this. To priest and parish, whatsoever is anointed of God bears an office whose authority can no longer be disputed or assailed. To the parish priest, and to his subjects, the nation, an uncrowned king is a similitude of a person who has been named for holy orders, but has not been consecrated. He has no office. He has not been ordained. Another may be appointed to his place. In a word, an uncrowned king is a doubtful king. But if God appoint him and his servant the bishop anoint him, the doubt is annihilated. The priest and the parish are his loyal subjects straightway, and while he lives they will recognize no king but him. To Joan of Arc, the peasant girl, Charles VII was no king until he was crowned. To her he was only the Dauphin, that is to say, the heir. If I have ever made her call him king, it was a mistake. She called him the Dauphin, and nothing else, until after the coronation. It shows you as in a mirror, for Joan was a mirror in which the lowly hosts of France were clearly reflected, that to all that vast underlying force called the people, He was no king, but only dauphin before his crowning, and was indisputably and irrevocably king after it. Now you understand what a colossal move on the political chessboard the coronation was. Bedford realized this by and by, and tried to patch up his mistake by crowning his king. But what good could that do? None in the world. Speaking of chess, Joan's great acts may be likened to that game. Each move was made in its proper order, and it was great and effective because it was made in its proper order and not out of it. Each, at the time made, seemed the greatest move, but the final result made them all recognizable as equally essential and equally important. This is the game as played. 1. Joan moves to Orleans and Pathé. Check. 2. Then moves the reconciliation, but does not proclaim check, it being a move for position and to take effect later. 3. Next she moves the coronation. Check. 4. Next, the bloodless march. Check. 5. Final move, after her death, the reconciled Constable Richemont to the French king's elbow. Checkmate. End of chapter 33. Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain. Volume 2, Book 2, Chapter 34, The Jests of the Burgundians. The campaign of the Loire had as good as opened the road to Reims. There was no sufficient reason now why the coronation should not take place. The coronation would complete the mission which Joan had received from heaven, and then she would be forever done with war, and would fly home to her mother and her sheep, and never stir from the hearthstone and happiness any more. That was her dream. And she could not rest, she was so impatient to see it fulfilled. She became so possessed with this matter that I began to lose faith in her two prophecies of her early death. And, of course, when I found that faith wavering, I encouraged it to waver all the more. The king was afraid to start to Reims, because the road was mile-posted with English fortresses, so to speak. Joan held them in light esteem, and not things to be afraid of in the existing modified condition of English confidence. And she was right. As it turned out, the march to Reims was nothing but a holiday excursion. Joan did not even take any artillery along, she was so sure it would not be necessary. We marched from Gien 12,000 strong. This was the 29th of June. The maid rode by the side of the king. On his other side was the Duc d'Alençon. After the Duke followed three other princes of the blood. After these followed the Bastard of Orleans, the Marshal de Boussac, and the Admiral of France. After these came La Hire, Saint-Tré, Tremouille, and a long procession of knights and nobles. We rested 3 days before Auxerre. The city provisioned the army, and a deputation waited upon the king. But we did not enter the place. Saint-Florentin opened its gates to the king. On the 4th of July we reached Saint-Phal, and yonder lay Troyes before us, a town which had a burning interest for us boys, for we remembered how 7 years before, in the pastures of Domremy, the Sunflower came with his black flag and brought us the shameful news of the Treaty of Troyes, that treaty which gave France to England, and a daughter of our royal line in marriage to the butcher of Agincourt. That poor town was not to blame, of course, yet we flushed hot with that old memory, and hoped there would be a misunderstanding here, for we dearly wanted to storm the place and burn it. It was powerfully garrisoned by English and Burgundian soldiery, and was expecting reinforcements from Paris. Before night we camped before its gates, and made rough work with a sortie which marched out against us. Joan summoned Troyes to surrender. Its commandant, seeing that she had no artillery, scoffed at the idea, and sent her a grossly insulting reply. 5 days we consulted and negotiated. No result. The king was about to turn back now and give up. He was afraid to go on, leaving this strong place in his rear. Then La Hire put in a word, with a slap in it, for some of His Majesty's advisers. "The Maid of Orleans undertook this expedition of her own motion, and it is my mind that it is her judgment that should be followed here, and not that of any other, let him be of whatsoever breed and standing he may." There was wisdom and righteousness in that. So the king sent for the maid, and asked her how she thought the prospect looked. She said, without any tone of doubt or question in her voice,
In 3 days' time the place is ours."
The smug chancellor put in a word now.
"If we were sure of it, we would wait her 6 days."
"6 days, forsooth! Name of God, man, we will enter the gates to-morrow."
Then she mounted and rode her lines, crying out,
"Make preparation! To your work, friends! To your work! We assault at dawn!"
She worked hard that night, slaving away with her own hands like a common soldier. She ordered fascines and faggots to be prepared and thrown into the fosse, thereby to bridge it, and in this rough labor she took a man's share. At dawn she took her place at the head of the storming force, and the bugles blew the assault. At that moment a flag of truce was flung to the breeze from the walls, and Troy surrendered without firing a shot. The next day the king, with Joan at his side and the paladin bearing her banner, entered the town in state at the head of the army. And a goodly army it was now, for it had been growing ever bigger and bigger from the first. And now a curious thing happened. By the terms of the treaty made with the town, the garrison of English and Burgundian soldiery were to be allowed to carry away their goods with them. This was well, for otherwise how would they buy the wherewithal to live? Very well. These people were all to go out by the one gate, and at the time set for them to depart, we young fellows went to that gate, along with the dwarf, to see the march out. Presently here they came in an interminable file, the foot soldiers in the lead. As they approached, one could see that each bore a burden of a bulk and weight to sorely tax his strength, and we said among ourselves, "Truly these folk are well off for poor common soldiers." When they were come nearer, what do you think? Every rascal of them had a French prisoner on his back. They were carrying away their goods, you see, their property, strictly according to the permission granted by the treaty. Now think how clever that was, how ingenious! What could a body say? What could a body do? For certainly these people were within their right. These prisoners were property. Nobody could deny that. My dears, if those had been English captives, conceive of the richness of that booty. For English prisoners had been scarce and precious for 100 years, whereas it was a different matter with French prisoners. They had been overabundant for a century. The possessor of a French prisoner did not hold him long for ransom, as a rule, but presently killed him to save the cost of his keep. This shows how small was the value of such a possession in those times. When we took Troyes, a calf was worth 30 francs, a sheep 16, a French prisoner 8. It was an enormous price for those other animals, a price which naturally seems incredible to you. It was the war, you see. It worked two ways. It made meat dear, and prisoners cheap. Well, here were these poor Frenchmen being carried off. What could we do? Very little of a permanent sort, but we did what we could. We sent a messenger flying to Joan, and we and the French guards halted the procession from our parley, to gain time, you see. A big Burgundian lost his temper and swore a great oath that none should stop him. He would go, and would take his prisoner with him. But we blocked him off, and he saw that he was mistaken about going. He couldn't do it. He exploded into the maddest cursings and revilings then, and unlashing his prisoner from his back, stood him up, all bound and helpless, then drew his knife, and said to us with a light of sarcastic triumph in his eye,
"I may not carry him away, you say? Yet he is mine, none will dispute it. Since I may not convey him hence, this property of mine, there is another way. Yes, I can kill him. Not even the dullest among you will question that right. Ah, you had not thought of that, vermin."
That poor starved fellow begged us with his piteous eyes to save him, then spoke and said he had a wife and little children at home. Think how it wrung our heartstrings. But what could we do? The Burgundian was within his right. We could only beg and plead for the prisoner, which we did, and the Burgundian enjoyed it. He stayed his hand to hear more of it, and laugh at it. That stung. Then the dwarf said,
"Prithee, young sirs, let me beguile him, for when a matter requiring permission is to the fore, I have indeed a gift in that sort, as any will tell you that know me well. You smile, and that is punishment for my vanity, and fairly earned, I grant you. Still, if I may toy a little, just a little," saying which he stepped to the Burgundian and began a fair soft speech, all of goodly and gentle tenor, and in the midst he mentioned the maid,
and was going on to say how she, out of her good heart, would prize and praise this compassionate deed which he was about to— It was as far as he got. The Burgundian burst into his smooth oration with an insult leveled at Joan of Arc. We sprang forward, but the dwarf, his face all livid, brushed us aside and said in a most grave and earnest way, "I crave your patience. Am not I her guard of honor? This is my affair." And saying this, he suddenly shot his right hand out and gripped the great Burgundian by the throat, and so held him upright on his feet. "You have insulted the maid," he said, "and the maid is France. The tongue that does that earns a long furlough." One heard the muffled cracking of bones. The Burgundian's eyes began to protrude from their sockets and stare with a leaden dullness at vacancy. The color deepened in his face and became an opaque purple. His hands hung down limp, his body collapsed with a shiver, every muscle relaxed its tension and ceased from its function. The dwarf took away his hand, and the column of inert mortality sank mushily to the ground. We struck the bonds from the prisoner and told him he was free. His crawling humbleness changed to frantic joy in a moment, and his ghastly fear to a childish rage. He flew at that dead corpse and kicked it, spat in its face, danced upon it, crammed mud into its mouth, laughing, jeering, cursing, and volleying forth indecencies and bestialities like a drunken fiend. It was a thing to be expected. Soldiering makes few saints. Many of the onlookers laughed. Others were indifferent. None was surprised. But presently, in his mad caperings, the freedman capered within reach of the waiting file, and another Burgundian promptly slipped a knife through his neck, and down he went with a death shriek, his brilliant artery blood spurting 10 feet as straight and bright as a ray of light. There was a great burst of jolly laughter all around from friend and foe alike, and thus closed one of the pleasantest incidents of my checkered military life. And now came Joan hurrying and deeply troubled. She considered the claim of the garrison, then said, "You have right upon your side. It is plain. It was a careless word to put in the treaty, and covers too much. But ye may not take these poor men away. They are French, and I will not have it. The king shall ransom them, every one. Wait till I send you word from him, and hurt no hair of their heads. For I tell you, I who speak, that that would cost you very dear." That settled it. The prisoners were safe for one while, anyway. Then she rode back eagerly and required that thing of the king, and would listen to no paltering and no excuses. So the king told her to have her way, and she rode straight back and bought the captives free in his name, and let them go. End of chapter 34.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join us again next week as Radio Lillooet's special presentation of the personal recollections of Joan of Arc by Mark Twain continues.